First case on our calendar is 96-536, State of Ohio versus Warren Hennis. Mr. Gray.
Thank you, sir. My name is David Gray. I'm a representative of Hennis. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes.
Watch your time there.
We set this stage for the first few issues in the case. I would like to discuss the testimony of that. Real quickly, what happened here is just before Spatton has took the stand, the trial judge, under the rule, questioned her with respect to whether she was affirmatively electing to testify against her husband, Warren Hennis. There's no question that she was married to Warren Hennis. She was married on November 11, 1991. The trial was through in 1993. There was a question and answer session both by the trial judge and by the prosecuting attorney and also by the defense counsel. At the conclusion of that, she did indeed testify on direct examination. She testified for approximately half the name on November 22nd of 1993, and then, which was a Monday, and then after the conclusion of her direct testimony, she leaves and goes to Texas. I think it's important for the court to understand and to recognize that the judge, before she testified in direct examination, although questioning her, made a no affirmative finding with respect to her voluntary election. That is specifically what is required under State v. Adamson, which has been authored by this court about a year ago. So,
let's assume she waived that. Can you waive and then recant? Because she went away saying she was afraid and they found her and brought her back, or she came back.
I agree with that. What's important here is you have the foundation that she did not, in fact, the judge did not, in fact, make a legal finding that the Vatican had waived her election to testify. Then she leaves and she's gone for approximately a week.
Okay, well, let's stop here a minute. He didn't make a finding specifically of waiver, but she testified.
Yes, sir.
I mean, do we have to make a specific finding of something that is clear?
And with all due respect to what the trial judge did here, sir, I don't think it is clear because of what happened right after she came back. The testimony shows, and the record is clear on this, that Mr. Hogan basically said that if she didn't appear, she was going to be arrested. He said there was a warrant out for her arrest. The judge, when she comes back, says nothing about election, but he, in essence, scolds her, admonishes her, and says on the record that you have caused a great deal of problem, you have wasted a lot of people's time and money and effort and so forth. And in essence, he does the exact opposite. He insists that she testified, and again, compounding the first lack of finding, he again does not make this affirmative disclosure with respect to the
Let us get back to that lack of finding. What would you have the trial court do to satisfy you?
What I would have the trial court do is make
a... Or to satisfy the case that you feel that he did not follow. What does he have to do?
I would say under 601B is my opinion, and I make a specific finding as a trial judge that the Vatican specifically waives her rights under the statute.
So you would have him make a formal declaration of the obvious that he has... He has concluded that this is a voluntary, knowingly done act by this person, and that she has waived her privilege about that she has been advised that she has, and the court is of the opinion that she's done this knowingly and intelligently. And unless that's done, what?
Then there is no specific finding that she has done that she is actually testifying voluntarily.
Okay, the fact that the court allowed the witness after this interrogation to testify is not an indication that the court felt that all those requirements were met?
I agree with you that there is an indication. I agree with that. I agree that there is an indication that she is voluntarily doing that. But it's her conduct afterwards which creates the new twist and which is...
In order to satisfy that basic problem you're arguing about, after she starts testifying, has nothing to do with what the court should have done before she testified, correct? The court determined that she waived, that she was intelligently making this decision and so forth, and she started to testify. Now you want us to have the court consider things that happen after she starts testifying to see whether or not he properly let her testify to begin with?
Yes, and the reason is because of what her conduct right afterwards. I understand what you're saying, and I understand that I give you this. Under Adamson, if she had testified and she hadn't left, then there would have been, so to speak, harmless error, even though everyone agrees that the trial judge did not make any specific finding. But she said on the record, I have trouble testifying against my husband. She was under almost like judicial restraint or guard. He said when she left.
So what you're saying is that under the circumstances of this case, the trial court had an obligation to re-inquire after the witness came back as to what her intentions were. Is that what you're saying? And he didn't do that.
He absolutely did not.
And you feel he should have.
Pardon me?
And you feel he should have done that.
Absolutely, because of the gap in time and because of what she said when she walks in the door.
That's why I'm asking you if once you have elected, in effect, waive, can you recant? Now, the rule doesn't, I certainly follow your argument, but the rule doesn't say that, does it?
The rule does not say that.
And we follow 601B, spouse testifying against the other spouse is incompetent, except, two, the testifying spouse elects to testify. She elected originally to testify, did she not? I mean, she didn't express, as I read, that exchange between the judge and the lawyers and the witness. She didn't express any reservation about testifying to start with.
I agree.
Okay. So the issue we have to deal with is, once she's elected to testify, can she withdraw her election?
That's correct. And Adamson, in lieu of 601B, sir, Adamson says that the trial judge has an affirmative duty to ensure that this person, namely Pat Dennis, is testifying voluntarily and that she elected. And when she says all these things in the interim, in between November 22nd and November 29th, when she comes back, you've got to have some sort of a finding that this is an affirmative duty on the part of the trial court to do this. And they did not do it. He did the exact opposite. He scolded her and said, what have you done here?
I suspect that the next step of this is that your contention is that her testimony was most crucial to his conviction.
Yes, it was. Now, I'm losing time. I realize that this is an important issue, but there's some extremely important issues in this case, and I'm going to try to...
Counsel, before you move up, I'll back up just to the beginning of this. Do you concede that the judge properly handled her testimony at the outset? In other words, the record indicates that he determined that she was, his focus was the voluntariness of her testimony, and that he went through that on the record, and that her initial testimony was fine. Do you concede that?
Yes, sir, I do.
Okay, so it's just the point of her return, and the issue that we're going to have to determine as to whether or not there's irretrievable waiver once you're properly advised and begin testimony, or whether at a later point in time, you can stop the music and say, well, I don't want to go on.
I agree with what you just said. And he even mentions at the beginning that you would have the right to change your mind. He does, I don't know if he says change your mind, but he does, he gives a good rendition of what this lady.
So initially, it's fine.
Yes.
Well, what happens then if, let's say she had to run away, she just says she has to find you, take your reset, you come back, you're ready to cross-examine her now, and she says, oh, I've changed my mind, I feel really bad, I feel bad about this, if I get my husband, I don't want to say anything anymore. What you're proposing is a rule that she can at that point shut up, and you effectively lose your right to cross-examine. That's the end result of what you're proposing, isn't it?
That's a point in which I believe it would be within the discretion of the judge either to strike her testimony or to Judge Stratton, either strike her testimony or to order her because she did it initially. But
is that what happened here?
No, it did not. The thing that happened here was the, if you read, and I'm sure you all have, but if you read from the point where she leaves, and then the activity that occurred between the afternoon of the 22nd and the morning of the 29th, which was Thanksgiving weekend, but it was still work days except for Thursday. If you read what actually happens here is what they did to get this lady back. And
but she contacted them and said, I'll come back. They didn't track her down and I need the record. She contacted them.
Contacted them because her social worker in Texas, her counselor, so to speak, said that you're going to be arrested if you don't go back.
And isn't that true? Wasn't she under subpoena?
She was under subpoena, but she could not be arrested because of that statute 2939.4 or whatever.
Well, is that the prosecutor's fault that somebody in Texas is giving her that advice?
No, it's not, but it just gives an indication of what this lady would. She said this when she came back before she testified on cross-examination. She said, I have trouble testifying against my husband.
What if she said that simply during the reset?
Then I think that would have been within the discretion of the judge, and I think that you're...
So she leaves the jurisdiction for 4 or 5 days, the judge loses discretion, but she doesn't go to reset, the judge has discretion.
But the important point is here is there was never any affirmative finding to indicate what she is doing. That's the problem with the case. The next issue is marital communications. It's 2945.42, and I don't have much time, but what is really critical here is on March 20th, Pat Tennis is asleep on the couch of Von Furst residence in Skidmore. She answers the phone, and there is a telephone from this person who says, no question, that's hearsay. But from the 24-hour period of time between March 20th of 1992 and March 21st of 1992, Bath and Hennis and Warren Hennis were alone. And under the marital communication statute, there is absolutely no way that this testimony should have been allowed under two reasons. One being the telephone is hearsay, conversation, and the other reason is because everyone agrees that these two were together until the next day when Roman Fair leaves them over on 4th and High Street. So what I'm saying is that all of this testimony that was introduced, which is a crucial link between the 91 acclaim, the car, the fact that Warren Hennis came back, none of that is admissible. And it was not objected to, but it is not supposed to be in front of the jury because of 2941.45.42, which is the marital communications statute. So now the prosecutor in her brief says this is just almost like powerless material, but it's not important. It is absolutely crucial because if the jury first off hears that the 91 acclaim and Warren Hennis are together for the first time on the 21st of March, so the 20th, then that is absolutely important. It's significant. Now, closely associated with that is the telephone call, which is, there's no question the telephone call is hearsay. There Judge Petrie in this court of appeals decision says that it's harmless error. He admits that it's there, but it's harmless error. And Hogan, when he got the judge to overrule the motion, said, or the objection, I'm sorry, said that it's not hearsay because it's not a fact, and it says in response to that's all function. The reason why the conversation was introduced was because they wanted to prove the truth of the matter asserted, and that is Keith there? This is that's Richard Myers. And if that isn't crucial, then I don't know what is. So you have three correlated issues here which are extremely important to the outcome of this case and which affect the jury's determination.
But aren't all the key conversations overheard by either Curtis or in the downstairs in the kitchen area or Fair when they were in the car together?
No, sir.
Doesn't that bring about a waiver?
No, sir. I agree with you that if it's done in front of a third party, then under the Marital Communications Act, there's a question that brings about the fact that it should have been brought in. The bathroom makes a vague statement that says that if it's a small house, then you should think it should be heard everywhere.
Smaller than the courtroom in which the case was tried.
Yes. But there is no indication from Bob Curtis, and there's no indication that these statements were done in the presence of Bob Curtis, who was the owner of the house. Real quickly, there are a couple more extremely crucial issues in this case. I'm trying to do this as quickly as I can. The next issue is what we call right to counsel. And what happened here is something that was completely blown both by the court of appeals and by the trial judge, because they confused the Sixth Amendment right to counsel with the Fifth Amendment right to counsel. What happened real quickly is that Warren Hennis is arrested on April 9th of 1992 in the afternoon. Bath is also arrested. What they do is they wait, the detectives wait until they talk to Bath. And then at 11:25 p.m., they interview Warren Hennis. And for the most part of 3 hours until 2:28, he is interrogated. After the interview, right at 2:28 on April 9th of 1992, he says, I think I need a lawyer because if I tell everything I know, how do I know if I know? But Petrie and the Court of Appeals says this is a vague response for an attorney. This is the equivocal response for an attorney. That is anything but an equivocal response. That is unequivocal. He says, I think I need an attorney, and then he gives the foundational reasons why he wants to have an attorney. And the reasons are exactly what he says later on. Clarence Sorrell comes over 5 days later and talks to him. Namely, that he was in the area and that they might charge him with a complicity charge. So what I am saying here, this is not Davis versus the United States where the fellow in the Navy said, I think I need an attorney. This is an unequivocal statement saying, I want an attorney because you guys are going to get me with a complicity charge.
What did he say after that?
He started answering questions that the police officer just kept on questioning. And then he started responding to questions dealing with the homicide. Now,
did he ever ask or indicate his desire or his thoughts or his feelings about an attorney after that?
No, sir. What?
So you would have us say that at any time a person mentions a lawyer or I don't know what I should do, maybe I should get a lawyer, you have to stop and get that man a lawyer.
No, sir, I'm not saying that at all.
What does the officer have to do then?
I agree with what you just said, and that is in Davis, the fellow said, I think I need an attorney. I agree. If Warren Hennis had said, I think I need an attorney, I'm out the door, right? This is not an issue. But if he says the reasons why he needs an attorney, then he gives the reasons, and the very reason is because he thinks he's going to be charged with complicity.
That makes the difference.
Yes, sir. And the other thing that makes the difference is Dan Hogan, an experienced prosecutor, says in the trial that I am stopping this tape. I'm sorry, I am stopping this tape I believe that this is a request from an attorney. So the jury, in State Exhibit 9, did not hear anything after the request for an attorney. Now, there's the Court of Appeals misses this completely because they basically equate this with the Sixth Amendment rights of the constitution. It's not that at all. This is brand new. Edwards versus Arizona was written because of this very rule. And Edwards said it relates, it's a twin of mine. It says exactly what happened here. When a person requests an attorney and gives the reason, then Clarence Sorrell and the entire Columbus Department is not allowed to come out of the warrant and still be supplied with an attorney. And he was not. And the reason this is crucial is because State's Exhibit 10 is the audio tape, and that was introduced, and that talks about, and in fact, he says that he was in the area of Nelson Road, 600 North Nelson. And he says that a bunch of people structures that were on Nelson were killed. It's crucial. And to say that this is not a request for an attorney, and then for Clarence Sorrell to say, I came down here, they didn't want to talk to him. You're just abusing Miranda and Edwards. So that alone is extremely important. I do need to say a few things about the specifications, because the specifications are extremely critical here. Because both bodies, the jury and the trial judge, absolutely did not rely on the proper specifications here. There are two specifications. One is under A7, is the aggravated robbery, and the other one is the one under kidnapping. And the trial judge at page 248, line 8 of the transcript says he gives an instruction in this disjunction. That's the only thing he does right with respect to the specification. Then, 20 pages later, he has got the packet of the verdicts. And he tells the jury, now, if you think this guy is guilty, write down, say that he's guilty of both parent calculation and design, and principal offender status. So what they did was, this is one of the most unusual specifications I've ever seen, because the jury, after hearing the jury instructions from the judge, page 268, follows his improper instructions, and they write expressly in the verdicts, they say, we find that Warren Dennis was guilty of both primary calculation and design and principal offender status, which is absolutely incorrect under state defense. Then, to make matters worse, in his opinion, the judge uses as a basis for affirming the death sentence the exact wording of the statute, which is allowed.
Why do you claim that's error? Because those are then being raised to the status of aggravating circumstance?
Yes.
Because you can be both the principal offender and have prior calculation design.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Because you can be both the principal offender and have prior calculation design.
Yeah, but Penix specifically says, and if the jury so expressly finds, you've got an improper death penalty. Under count one, which is the count that is before this court right now, if you use prior calculation and design and principal status as a basis to affirm the death penalty, it's improper. And Judge Petrie does say in his court of appeals,
yes,
he says that the trial judge used prior calculation and design as a basis for the aggravating circumstance. You can't do that.
Not as the basis for an aggravated circumstance, but as an aggravated circumstance.
Right.
Okay, and that's what makes it error, if it is error at all.
Exactly.
Because once again, you can be both you have prior calculation design and be the principal offender. You just can't raise it to an aggravating circumstance level.
Which is what was done here. And what is unusual about this case is normally you can't tell whether the jury has done it or not. In this case, it's right in the record. They did it. And then the judge uses property acquisition and design. So the two most important bodies before this reaches you that heard the evidence are the ones that use property acquisition and design as the basis of permanent I would like to conclude the first part of this argument.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Grave. Ms. Anderson.
Testifying, answering the prosecutor's question.
That's correct.
That's different than the example you just gave us.
Well, it's a different example. I don't think this principle is any different because the defendant, once he elects to testify, cannot choose to say, I'm only going to answer my own lawyer's questions. Nor could Mr. Pennant say, I'm only going to answer one lawyer's questions. I don't think it matters which lawyer is asking the questions. Once the election to testify is made. If the defendant cannot reassert a Fifth Amendment right, then a witness should not be allowed to reassert a lesser right, a statutory right, to refuse to testify. Otherwise, it would put the proceedings of the court at the discharge of witnesses. There would be all sorts of problems. There would be mistrials. Spouses could come in and say, oh, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to cause a mistrial. I'm going to say I'm going to testify. Then I'll testify. And as the defendant wants to talk to me, I'll say, I changed my mind. That's a mistrial.
What about...
Go ahead. Excuse me. Go ahead, sir.
What about the concern about the credibility of a witness who... has Tabatha here who decides after thinking about this that she doesn't really want to testify against her husband. Does that raise any problems in your mind with her credibility if she's forced to testify as the defendant argues here she essentially was?
Well, your question includes a couple of premises. If there is a problem with credibility, it certainly can be brought into cross-examination, as Mr. Bodiger did cross-examine her about why she left and where she's been and who she's talked to since, on and on and on. I disagree with the implication of the question that she was forced to come back. As Judge Stanton pointed out, she called us. However, the question being credibility, I think, is an issue to be taken care of during cross-examination.
Well, looking at the issue beyond this case, which I think seems to me we have to, would a remedy for what happens when a witness decides they no longer want to waive their right to not testify, would the remedy be to strike the earlier testimony?
I have seen some trial courts who have done that. I have never seen, or at least I do not remember seeing, a case from an appellate court saying that is an appropriate remedy or was an appropriate remedy or is a necessary remedy. I have seen once in a while a trial court do that where a witness disappeared and could not be found. Does that answer your question?
I'm still concerned about the break here, and you say you can't reassert your Fifth Amendment rights. Supposing she was in the position of testifying here, and halfway through, you or somebody else said to her, oh, by the way, weren't you involved in that bank robbery 3 weeks ago? She has no right to exercise her right?
No, I don't mean to say that. That's
so you can, can't you?
That's a different issue. A Fifth Amendment privilege, I don't think that by describing, by electing to testify and therefore eliminating the competency problem, that she has also waived her Fifth Amendment right. Defendants have that right, too. Defendants can say, can get on the stand and say, well, I'll answer this specific question and that specific question. What I meant was they cannot get on the stand and testify and then refuse to answer questions about what they had said on direct. They still can't assert more particular questions. I refuse to answer that. They just can't say, I'm not going to talk to you at all, Mr. Prosecutor, once they have provided direct.
But your main argument is this is a statutory right that doesn't rise to the level of a constitutional issue, and if it isn't a constitutional issue, she's waived her right under the statute.
That is correct. And also the state would assert that if she did decide to reassert her competency or incompetency, then she decided again to testify by coming back. She said some things about, I knew I should be doing this, but it's not entirely clear that she came back just because she was worried that she would be arrested for skipping out. I think it's an easy...
You did have a warrant out for her.
Well, this is correct. I have a bench warrant out for her.
That's pretty persuasive.
And excuse me.
That's pretty persuasive.
That may well have been a large part in her decision. But what I'm saying is by saying, I knew I should be doing this, I think that could be as easily interpreted as saying I have a civic duty to testify about this murder that my husband has committed. And, I mean, we don't know. We can't know for sure what her reasons were, but those reasons were discussed during cross. The jury knew everything. The jury knew everything that had been said to her. The jury knew all of the discussions. We would suggest that if there is any compulsion issue here, that the jury had all the facts they needed to decide that, and it relates to credibility, which Judge Moyer discussed.
What about the marital privilege?
The state's position, and I may have been a little bit unclear when I read my brief, we're not conceding that anything privileged came in. I one sense that my brief might have been a bit misleading on that point.
Yeah, you seem to say that the privilege is there, but here it was overcome because of the vocale of the statements and who was there.
I realized when I read it that it might have implied that was not my intention. Our position is that nothing privileged came in, that the witness was told, you are only to tell us what was said in the presence of third persons. You're not to tell us anything that was said while you and your husband were alone. Mr. Grape refers to the conduct of going out of the house and getting into the car with the defendant, with the victim. Of course, the victim is present. So even if that conduct was intended to be communicative, it was in the presence of the third person. When the defendant came back with the car and found the victim, the conduct of coming back with the car is not communicative conduct. And the rule itself says that a defendant's or a spouse's location is not included in the rule. The spouse's location was in the victim's car. That's not included in the rule. It's not precluded by the privilege. I'm glad I had that opportunity to clear that up, but our position is that nothing privileged came in. The only two examples that we cite were in the known presence of a third person. We suggest that the court could reasonably infer that Mr. Curtis, who was there in the kitchen, heard what the defendant was saying, and that the defendant knew that Mr. Curtis was in his own house. These people were guests in Mr. Curtis's house, And it's reasonable to infer that the defendant knew he was there.
Ms. Anderson, it's hard to speculate, but I guess I need to ask you. Would the defendant have been convicted without her testimony?
I don't know. Rowan Fair said almost the same things as she said. Even coming back with the car, Rowan Fair the next day also saw the victim with the car. Rowan Fair testified to the victim saying that he told him. Rowan Fair said almost everything, however, I do think that the wife's testimony added to the conviction.
In any event, the evidence is not overwhelming as we see in most of these cases without her testimony.
Well, Your Honor, I think I beg to differ with that, too. I mean, I think the evidence is pretty overwhelming. We've got the credit cards, the checkbook, the car.
And Fair.
The one thing that she said that no one else said was that he left with the victim. And
that she told him to tell somebody.
That bothers me less because the defendant did say, I killed him. So the fact that Tabitha tells him to say, I killed him, I don't think is crucial. However, it is a crucial piece of evidence that Tabitha saw the victim and the defendant leave together and saw the defendant come back 2 hours later in the victim's car without the victim. So I guess I'm going to agree with you that it is crucial and he would not have been.
Doesn't your case get weaker if you eliminate the conversation of the defendant with the police officer?
Get weaker? Well, our case gets weaker if we eliminate any piece of evidence. Seriously weaker? I don't think so, because when the only thing that the defendant said with the police officer was exculpatory. He said to the police officer, Roland Fair did it all. The second time around, he said to the police officer, it was this gang of Cubans. He never really confessed to the police officer.
He certainly puts himself there, though.
I beg your pardon?
Didn't he put himself there for the proximity?
No.
The
second time, yes, he did say, I was outside.
What do you feel the obligation of the interrogating officer is when the person indicates quite intelligently that, wait a minute now, I might need an attorney because what we're about to talk about may implicate me or may get me as a complicity or may get me aiding and abetting, or some indication to the officer that he does, as counsel said, does have a good reason now to stop and maybe talk to an attorney. What does that officer have? What's his obligation?
Davis v. United States, Your Honor, his obligation is absolutely nothing. Davis v. United States says, Miranda is a bright line test. I want a lawyer. The only way it can remain a bright line test is if we keep it a bright line and say that a request from counsel is, I want a lawyer. That in Davis v. United States, the remark was, maybe I should have a lawyer. And the court said, if we go on and say, well, it's maybe I should have, I think I should have, if we say that these are going to be requests from counsel, then we are eliminating the bright line. And so under Davis v. United States, the answer to your question.
Well, then doesn't the officer have an obligation then to tell the defendant, now, the only way I can get you a lawyer is if you say, I want a lawyer. Shouldn't we inform the defendant that the bright line test is that you have to use certain words, and if you don't use them, buddy, I'm not going to get you a lawyer?
No.
We're holding the defendant with the knowledge that he must use those words to get a lawyer without any information that he may never have heard that before?
I'm not saying that he has to say, I want a lawyer.
Well, you just told me that.
Example.
No, you just told me that, because the case says,
no, Your Honor. Sorry,
if he doesn't use, I want a lawyer,
no, Your Honor.
It's out of the ballgame. You
no,
didn't
Your
say
Honor,
that.
I did not say that. What I said was,
well, let's listen to the tape after the argument, and I'll say that you did say that.
I want a lawyer could, for example, be said, yes, get
the words can vary.
Of course.
It's the import to the words that's important,
exactly.
Isn't it?
Of course.
Well, then the words are open to interpretation then.
Well, certainly words are always open to interpretation.
Well, you
however,
just agreed that the import of the wording is important.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I missed that.
The maybe I'm making it too much obvious, and maybe we should go to something else. You say that there is not, now that you say there is no certain words that the person has to use to get their lawyer. You agree with that now?
I agree with that.
Okay.
As long as the meaning conveyed by those words is, I want a lawyer.
I'm in trouble and I better talk to someone.
I don't know whether that would be a request or not. I suppose it would, but it has to be, I want a lawyer, or, I'm not saying another word, to get a lawyer for me, or get a lawyer right here, right now, or I have nothing to say, I want a lawyer.
Okay.
I mean, it could be any number of words, but what it isn't is, I think maybe I should get a lawyer.
Because. For this reason, that's Mr. Gray's argument, is that he knew why he needed a lawyer, and so why should he have to say, demand, you get me a lawyer, to the jailer? Why shouldn't it be enough that he knows why, he's indicated to the jailer why he needs a lawyer?
Because the bright line test, the reasons don't matter. We don't care what his reasons are. What we care about is if he asking for a lawyer.
Well, in fact, you don't get him a lawyer, do you?
I'm sorry?
You don't. The officer doesn't get him a lawyer, does he? He lets him alone.
He stops questioning.
Yeah.
Oftentimes what they do is say, okay, no more questions. There's a phone. The important thing is not that the officer gets him a lawyer.
Well,
the important thing is that the officer does not question him without getting him a lawyer.
I think the concern is that that's what's supposed to happen, and the concern is, whenever you see these fact situations, is instead of saying, there's the phone, I can't go any further, does the officer try to cajole around the request for the lawyer and get a waiver?
Well, sometimes that does happen, and on those occasions, we don't try to introduce it.
Okay.
When he says, I want a lawyer, and the officer continues, we plead it.
So it's your opinion that when a person says what the defendant said in this case, I think I may need an attorney because of complicity, that the police have no obligation to address that issue.
Under Davis v. United States, I believe that that is the law. I know that this court has on previous occasions said that such equivocal responses that the officer should then go in and question. However, Davis v. United States, I believe, is now trumps those cases, if I may.
Anderson, I'd like to go back, if I might, because it's the one thing. The other matters are important in the case, but to me that marital privilege is very important. And I want to start by saying to you, I understand your argument, nothing privileged came in. Now, would you take your brief and look at it on page 6, please? On page 6 of your brief, you set forth 29-45-42. And we all know what the first part of it says, husband and wife shall not testify concerning the communication. The part I'm concerned about was made or act done in the known presence or hearing of a third person, and this is the part, competent to be a witness. If the third person, if the rule is written so that the third person must be competent to be a witness, did either of these two people testify? Fair testify, certainly. Did Curtis?
No, he did not.
Why?
I don't know the answer to that, Your
Honor. And yet, we then don't know whether or not that statement was made in the presence of somebody competent to be a witness, do we?
Our position is it was a reasonable inference. I'm assuming, as the rules provide, that competency is assumed unless it is shown to the contrary. Mr. Curtis was a 58-year-old man.
can't presume competency. That's why we voir dire children below the age of 10. Yeah.
They're presumed to be competent if they're not under 10.
If they're testifying. You're saying he didn't testify. That little clause is in there for some reason, and I've had to wrestle with it once before. I thought maybe you'd have an explanation for it. I mean, we have to determine that the witness is competent to testify before we know that the privilege has been waived, don't we?
Well, Your Honor, the court has on a prior occasion determined that this rule applies to people who are dead, and we have no way of determining that they're competent either if you say that they must be called to be determined competent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the reasons is that a lot of American privilege is spoken in front of children.
With children, it could well be a problem.
Perhaps the legislative intention was you have to prove that if you have a child in the house, that child's competent to testify or doesn't qualify as a jury person. And that seems to be a logical substitute.
Well, with children, then obviously there would be no presumption of competency. The court has held that the rule also applies if the person is the victim and is dead. And to go by what you said, that we can only determine whether they're competent or not if they testify, then that would not be true. You could not say that the victim was competent because obviously we can't call them to testify.
I didn't say that. I asked the question because I'm not sure. I'm not sure how you determine. What about the specification, the aggravating circumstance here? Did you raise the prior calculation design principal offenders at the level of an aggravating circumstance? I'm moving away from the medical privilege.
Are you asking?
When, as he indicates in the indictment and then even in the charge of the judge.
No, Your Honor, for the reason that the only time that the aggravating circumstances matter in terms of weighing against the mitigating factors is in the sentencing hearing. And in the sentencing hearing, or are you asking about the court's opinion?
Both, but I wanted you to point out that it's only in the mitigation stage that you, the penalty stage, that you have the question whether or not that aggravating circumstance is one that should not have been used to weigh against mitigation.
That's correct, Your Honor. Appendix only applies to the sentencing stage. And in the sentencing stage, the court instructed the jury only on the principal offender part. And in fact,
okay, now what about the opinion?
The opinion, what the court did was copy down. Well, actually, we left out the original principal offender, I think. No, the opinion is right. The opinion copied down the whole specification. I don't know why he made that error. There's nothing that I can see in the rest of the opinion that explains it. There's nothing that I can see in the rest of the opinion that shows what he relies on. The rest of the opinion talks entirely about the principal offender.
His charge differs from his opinion, doesn't it?
That's correct. Yes, it does.
And the crucial thing, according to you, would be the charge.
Well, certainly, because this court has on many occasions said that this court can correct, or an appellate court can correct errors in the sentencing opinion. The charge was correct in the mitigation in the sentence.
What about the verdict forms?
In the guilt part?
Counsel for the defendant stated that the jurors wrote in.
Well, this problem with the legislature making something mutually exclusive, which isn't really mutually exclusive, has caused problems like this all the time. This court has said in Burke that you don't have to choose before it goes to the jury. You can let the jury decide which of the two it is. And I'm not sure how you do that without having them both in there, because Penix says we can't separate them out. And I've yet to see anything that says the prosecutor has to decide in advance. Now, in this case, it's pretty clear that he was the principal offender, so possibly he could or should have decided in advance. But in a lot of cases, it's not that clear. And you have to be able to submit both of those to the jury. The jury disregarded its instructions, in fact, because the court said or in the alternative, prior calculation and design, and the verdict form is correct, the verdict form provides, or is not the principal offender, committed the murder prior calculation and design, and the jury just blindly ignored its instructions and the writing and chose both because the jury decided that both applied, and the jury found him guilty of the prior calculation and design murder count. And so we know that that's what the jury decided. It wasn't just an error. There again, this court has said that any errors in sentencing can be corrected, and it's only significant in the sentencing phase. This court can, in its own reweighing, consider the little bit of mitigation that was offered against the appropriate principal offender specification.
The principal offender still was an issue because he was saying that there did or the human did it, so it was the popular system.
Well, it's a little hard to say what he was saying. He did not testify at trial. He said the first time to the police that there did it, and they said, no, 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 they wasn't using such humans. The closest thing at the state, at his statement at trial was the people I was with. So it's a little hard to say who he was saying did it, because he changed his mind. Nick, I just understood your question.
I just say, you said, well, we as prosecutors probably could have taken that out, but it wasn't an issue, but it still really was an issue.
Well, what I meant to say by that is that there was not strong evidence here that anyone else was involved, and in some cases, you really don't know who the trigger person was. In some cases where you have two criminals, unless you get specific evidence from witnesses, you may not really know who the trigger person is. And that's a much more crucial case in which we ought to be allowed to submit it. Here, I don't think it would make a difference, although we think there was some evidence that it was coming out. Our position is that evidence is negligible.
Your worthy adversary didn't discuss it, but I'm concerned about his proposition of Law 5. Did the prosecutor comment on the defendant's silence?
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
Because on page 49 of his brief, they start setting that forth. Now,
what the prosecutor said, and I believe that this was in the sentencing, it was in the final closing argument. What the prosecutor said is, they submitted a report from a police out of the jail showing that he had been previously raped or anything he reported a rape. And what the prosecutor said was, they submitted this piece of evidence, that's their entire case.
It happened in the sentencing phase. No, it happened in the penalty phase. Okay. Now, the prosecutor did make some comment with regard to the defendant's activities or silence or something, did he not?
Not that I remember, Your Honor. Do you remember the comment that you referred to?
So much of this, I can only remember that the proposition of Law 5, he specifically said that the prosecutor did thus and so on. I think it's in the penalty phase, and I think it had to do with the rape.
Well, Your Honor, since Mr. Gregg didn't cite a page, I wasn't too sure what he was referring to either. What I assumed he was referring to was the prosecutor's remark, they submitted this piece of evidence, and that is their whole case. I found nothing else that I could even consider to be a remark on defendant's silence. And the State v. Blaine talks about remarks like that, that it is acceptable for the prosecutor to say, our evidence has not been refuted, remarks to that kind. And at Griffin v. Illinois says, what you cannot say is you may consider the defendant's silence as evidence of guilt.
And that's why I asked, because I couldn't find anything else on it, and that, of course, is a fatal matter.
I agree, okay. But I found nothing.
Under the Thompson case, that's clearly fatal.
I agree, but I found nothing that would be that problem. Is there no other questions? The State would ask that the court affirm both the convictions
Thank you, Ms. Anderson. Mr. Gray, if you'd say a little over 5 minutes of your time.
Thank you, sir. I would like to discuss the specification here. I think the trial judge relies on it. So the two most important bodies. State versus... State versus Williams, this court said that until an attorney is actually given to this individual, the police cannot, and this is the court's thing, the police cannot come back. They can't even approach this man. So that attorney is applied to him, and that was not done in this case. Finally, with respect to the silence of the accused that Justice Douglas referred to, it is not in the penalty phase, it's in the first phase, it's in the trial stage. Mr. Boniker developed an extremely important and very persuasive and good argument with respect to this, the evidence of his warrant. Mr. Hogan is on in the phone. He belittles him, makes some ridiculous reference to a college professor in Bono or whatever. And then,
is that the elephant shoes and the platypus? I didn't understand any of that.
Either do I. And it's improper. I think it's belittling the system, and I think he's belittling David Goddard. Halfway through that argument, he then says, now what kind of defense did they put on? And he throws around the sheet of paper, which is the, as Ms. Anderson says, is the defense case.
Yeah, but their response to that is the fanciful tale told by the defendant about the college professor. Does that have any place there either?
She tries to explain it in her brief, and I cannot understand the logic. There was some indication by Mr. Byers that this was done in self-defense, and that is also belittled and mentioned by Dan Hogan in the rebuttal of the closing argument.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.